From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, marijuana shops on hold a little while longer, a new lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, and a ban on some short-term apartment rentals in Boston.
I'm concerned that completely eliminating investor units will push all the short-term rentals out of downtown and into the surrounding neighborhoods, where the most affordable housing exists today.
It's all part of our weekend review. Also, new court documents claim Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants.
The quota today is against Asians, much like the quota back in the 1920s and 30s was against Jews.
And why ultra-marathoner Scott Jurek wanted to break the record for running the Appalachian Trail.
It wasn't so much about the record. The record was the tool to push me that next level that I needed to push myself, to really see if I could get every ounce of effort out of my body, mind, and soul.
Next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins, and it's Friday. That means Week in Review. Let's dive right in now with a vote by Boston City Council to regulate short-term housing rentals such as HomeAway and Airbnb.
There are 11 votes in favor and 2 votes in opposition. The docket number 0764 passes.
The measure bans people from using these websites to rent out units that they don't live in. City Councilor Matt O'Malley says the new rules will ease Boston's housing crunch.
I support the innovation economy. I use the innovation economy. But as a legislator, I need to make sure that we are balancing both the opportunities for folks to be an Airbnb-type host, as well as the fact that it has removed thousands of units from our rolls of availability.
But then there's the argument of Andrew Scalaban, founder of the Boston Host Alliance. The group represents short-term rental operators and service providers in Boston. He's disappointed, and he says Cambridge's experience proves these regulations will not bring down costs. Cambridge has already restricted who can operate short-term rentals.
The big argument is that we're driving up housing prices, and once they get back all of these Airbnbs, that rent is just going to go plummeting. And Cambridge is a prime example where that didn't happen and actually went up 3.1% in the last year.
Our figures say the hike was between 2 and 3% on average. Is this a good move for the city of Boston? Joining us to talk about this and other issues, John Carroll, Boston University journalism professor and WBUR senior news analyst. Nice to see you, John.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political reporter and columnist, host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, welcome to you.
Thank you, Lisa.
So these are some of the most rigid short-term rental regulations in the country. These new rules essentially ban investors and tenants from renting homes by the night, but they do allow homeowners and owner-occupants of 2 and 3 family houses to do so. Joe, you first. Given the tight housing market, is this a smart move by Boston City Council?
I find it to be a pretty devastating move. It's a devastating for the short-term rental business. I think it's going to really put a dent in their business. It's going to cost people their jobs who work in that business. And I find it, frankly, to be an overreaction on the part of the Boston City Council. As the person said before, I don't think this is going to do anything to lower the prices of apartments in Boston or solve the affordability crisis that's going on in Boston.
Well, no surprise, Airbnb agrees with you. The company released a statement that read in part, "The new ordinance unfortunately creates a system that violates the privacy of our hosts and prevents Boston families from making much-needed extra income in one of the country's most expensive cities." HomeAway said the outcome here will have dangerous consequences for Boston's travel and tourism economy. John Carroll, what do you think?
Well, Airbnb has used a sort of a misdirection play from the very start here. They keep talking about Boston families. They keep talking about making ends meet, privacy. The issue here is really mostly about investor-owned units. And those are the ones that are being regulated the most. And those are the ones that are basically being regulated out of the field. So I think that the whole idea that this is hurting individual Bostonians could be true in some situations, but it's not entirely true, and it's not the focus of these regulations. That said, Airbnb is terrific at end running these kinds of regulations. Look to New Orleans, where basically they've changed their practices so that it's much harder to track short-term rentals in New Orleans. And they have some pretty stringent regulations. So I think it's going to be whether Boston can actually implement and enforce these regulations as opposed to what's happened in other cities.
So here's what Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley said. She's also, as we know, a congressional candidate. She supported the ban.
Short-term rentals are contributing to this public health crisis and epidemic that is the affordable housing crisis, and without regulation or data collection stands to become an even larger contributor to displacement.
So to that point, is this an appropriate solution to the lack of housing in the Boston area? What do you think,
Joe? Well, the affordable housing crisis has been going on long before the short-term rental business even really got going. This has been going on for a long time. I do think it's better that they ban, if they're going to ban anything, investor-owned apartments from this. But at the same time, they're also making everybody sign up and register for this, you know, anybody who does a short-term, which I find to be extremely unworkable. And it's going, you know, how do you even do that?
Why? So what you're saying is the hosts have to register their space with the city and pay
right.
a $200 fee.
How do you enforce that exactly?
John, do you see that as a problem?
I think it is going to be a problem. And the city is calling upon Airbnb and HomeAway and the other short-term rental companies to self-report every month and to be basically policing their listings. And I think that may be a fatal flaw here, because whether they will submit these reports or not is one thing, but whether they'll be accurate or not is another thing. So I think that the affordable housing crisis is something that is not going to be solved by this by any means. I mean, you're talking about 2,000 units at the highest estimate. So that's not even going to make a dent in the affordable housing problems that we have. So I think that this is a side issue, and it shouldn't divert people from addressing the serious affordable housing crisis that Boston and a lot of cities and towns in Massachusetts have.
It's a politically expedient way of saying, oh, we're doing something to solve the affordable housing crisis, when it goes, like John said, the crisis, the problem goes much deeper than this. And, politicians can do a lot different things than this to solve it.
Which if companies like Amazon end up moving to Boston, if that does happen, they're really going to have their hands full.
Yeah.
So let's shift to the statewide issue for a few minutes here of recreational marijuana, because in a little over 2 weeks, sales will become legal in Massachusetts, July 1st, the target date when shops open. But it seems less and less likely that any actually will open on that date, because the state's Cannabis Control Commission met yesterday. It has yet to issue a single business license for pot shops. Here's Steve Hoffman, who's chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, speaking to reporters.
Other states that rushed to hit an arbitrary deadline ended up with no inventory. In some cases, ended up with no licenses in place, no background checks being done, no online inventory being done. We are not going to do that. We're going to get it right. If that means we have few or no stores on July 1st and it takes a few more weeks, I hope and expect that everybody in the state believes that's the right thing to do. We certainly believe that's the right thing to do.
John Carroll, do you think it's the right thing to do? Could the commissioners be accused of foot dragging?
Well, this is moving so slowly, you'd think that maybe they're dipping into the merchandise, except that 4 out of 5 of the commissioners were against the ballot question when it first came up in 2016.
Do you think they're just then foot dragging, or just being cautious?
I think there's a certain amount of foot dragging. I think there's a certain amount of incompetence involved here, too. I mean, the rollout of medical marijuana was just as sort of halting as this one is. And it's already been delayed for 6 months. And that's one of the issues that critics are bringing up mostly, that it was supposed to, these pot shops were supposed to be in effect January 1st. The legislature put them off. And they're saying, Hoffman says, these are sort of goals, not a legislative mandate. It is a legislative mandate. The legislation says on and after July 1st, licenses shall be issued by the commission. And so I think that they've missed the legislative deadline, and I think that they should be held accountable for that.
Joe, what do you think is going on here?
What a shock that Massachusetts as a government is not ready for a mandate to enact a law that was approved by the voters. This is a voter-approved law.
Do you think it's not respecting the will of the voters?
I don't think it is, but at the same time, I kind of agree with the chairman that they shouldn't be rushing it. If they're not ready for it, they should be ready for it, first of all. And they're not ready for it. They should have been.
But, all right, let's look at the other point. I mean, they're really carving new ground here.
Right. Yeah, they are, but they've had time to get ready for this, and you know they've known about it for a long time. In fact, this was actually delayed from what the initial law said it should be. So they should have been ready, but I think it's probably smart if they're not ready to wait and until they've got all their act together.
On the other hand, there's a decided lack of urgency in the commission. They had a meeting yesterday, and they did not talk about licenses at that meeting. They talked about regulatory housekeeping. They talked about what are the metrics we're going to publicly report on to assess the performance of the commission, which those metrics they better hope they don't come out too soon. I think that they don't seem to feel that there is this real sense of urgency to this, that there are a lot of business people who are waiting and are sort of in limbo right now because they want to make plans. They have plans. They've made investments, and they're sort of stuck in nowhere.
Yeah. And even when they do approve the first few retail shops or cultivation facilities, I think it's going to be very, very slow rolling out.
Which is a bad thing, or
yeah,
not?
I think it's a bad. I think again, typical of Massachusetts government.
Okay, again, as Steve Hoffman of the Cannabis Control Commission says, they are doing background checks. They have to make sure that they have the inventory, et cetera. Something else that happened this week: the Special Commission on Operating Under the Influence and Impaired Driving met to talk about driving under the influence of legalized marijuana, because the state expects that's going to be a big problem after July 1st or whenever the shops actually happen to be open. Last fall, we should say, the state's Supreme Judicial Court ruled that field sobriety tests are not conclusive evidence of intoxication by marijuana. Let's hear what Walpole's Police Chief John Carmichael said this week. He was talking about how officers are conducting what is now called a roadside assessment for sobriety, but he says there's no formal process yet for pot DUI arrests.
The officer has to make some determination based on the circumstances as to whether or not they're going to bring that person in at arrest, or they have to make some determination that that person is free to leave and that they'll be okay.
And that point concerns Matt Allen of the Massachusetts chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union.
We want to make sure that that kind of test doesn't result in people being criminalized, particularly medical marijuana patients who may be marijuana users but may not be intoxicated.
So, gentlemen, from your perspectives, what's going on here? John?
Well, I think this is going to be really difficult because virtually every court case looks like it would be a jump ball. It would be the word of the officer against the word of the driver. And until they can come up with a test, and I think there's a test in
Colorado.
Somewhere, yeah. That basically measures the pupils of your eye. And I think that may be helpful, but I think that's also filled
sketchy.
With all kinds of,
yeah.
Right. I mean, there could be any number of reasons why your pupils are dilated. So I think this is going to be very difficult for the police to manage, and it's going to call for a lot of judgment, and there's going to be a lot of second guessing.
It's going to be a real problem. With no way of adequately measuring whether somebody is stoned or how stoned they are, I think the judge is going to throw out the case unless they have some evidence that the person beyond pupils or looking at their pupils or glassy eyes or whatever the cops say, it's kind of a difficult thing to prove.
We should say that Colorado, by the way, has established a certain THC level that is enough to charge someone there with DUI, although it still says that the science is not 100% on this. Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke to WBUR this week. She has introduced a new bill in Washington. It's called the States Act, which would allow states to pass their own marijuana laws without any kind of interference from the federal government. So Massachusetts law would trump federal law on this issue. President Trump said that he's willing to support the measure. Here's Liz Warren.
Folks in Massachusetts, just like folks in Colorado, got together and said, here's how we want to treat marijuana in Massachusetts. And now that that's the case, we think the federal government just ought to back off.
We should say the bill is co-sponsored by Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado. Joe, do you think it's a good idea?
I do think it's a good idea. I think you know that this is going to be. There's already a conflict between the states and the federal government that's looming. The federal government's still saying that pot should not be legal and states, you know, enacting it all over the country. So I hope that this doesn't drag out in Washington and that they get that they pass this.
John, on the other hand, Attorney General Jeff Sessions told Colorado Public Radio at the end of last week that he's waiting to see what comes of this legislation, but he will continue to enforce federal law as it's now written. Let's hear him.
The federal law remains in effect nationwide, just like it does for heroin or cocaine. Of course, it's not the death-dealing drug in the same way that fentanyl or heroin is, but it remains on the books as a prohibited substance.
Shot across the bow of Massachusetts?
Possibly, although the U.S. attorney here has said he's not interested in pursuing this right now. It's not high on his priorities list. And I think that that's the safeguard. I think this is the kind of legislation that's going to have a lot of trouble getting through Capitol Hill. And I think that if Jeff Sessions wants to start arm twisting, it could get much more complicated. But if it stays the status quo, I think most U.S. attorneys are just sitting back and letting nature take its course.
Is that something you can see Jeff Sessions doing, arm twisting?
A little bit, yeah.
We have one more local story with a national impact. Attorney General Maura Healey of Massachusetts is suing Purdue Pharma, maker of the powerful painkiller OxyContin. The state's Department of Public Health estimates that last year there were more than 2,000 opioid-related overdose deaths in the state. And Healey announced the civil suit against the company's top executives and family members of Raymond Sackler, Purdue Pharma's founder. Last June, Maura Healey and more than 35 other attorneys general announced a joint investigation into the marketing practices of manufacturers of opioids. And at a press conference, she said their investigation found that the individuals created the opioid epidemic and, quote, profited from it through a web of illegal deceit.
We found that Purdue misled doctors, patients, and the public about the real risks of their dangerous opioids, including OxyContin. We also found that they did this with the oversight and direction of 16 current and former executives and directors named in our complaint. Their strategy was simple. The more drugs they sold, the more money they made. And the more people died.
Purdue Pharma responded in a statement saying it is vigorously denying Healey's allegations and that its executives are, quote, disappointed that in the midst of good faith negotiations with many states, the Commonwealth has decided to pursue a costly and protracted litigation process. So question for you both. This is the first state lawsuit to name a company's top executives as being responsible. What do you make of this attempt at personal culpability, Joe?
I think, to be honest, it's partly a political stunt on Healey's part. It's a serious issue, and the evidence would suggest that actually the illicit fentanyl and heroin are the real problem. That's what's killing people right now, not even prescription drugs. People who are actually prescribed drugs are not the ones that are overdosing for by and large. So I think in partly it's a political reaction to a very complicated problem, a serious problem, but that she's looking to score political points.
John. Well, I think you can look at this in a couple of different ways. One is the current heroin epidemic is to some degree fueled by OxyContin and Purdue Pharmacy, because initially drug users were crushing and snorting the pills. Purdue reformulated the pills so that they can't be crushed and snorted in that way, and that has driven people to heroin and fentanyl and cheaper options. So there is that connection there. The other thing I would say is a couple of weeks ago, the New York Times did a really big takeout on the 2007 prosecution or investigation of Purdue Pharma, where there was a $600 million settlement. And to look at that, it seems from the evidence that Purdue Pharma knew in the late 90s that this illicit street trade was going on. And you can find street value and crush and snort in their internal documents. And basically, they were able to negotiate a settlement. Rudy Giuliani was one of the lawyers that that helped them negotiate that settlement without any indictments. And that was something that laid the foundation for what's happening now.
And if that settlement hadn't been reached, then the prosecutors wanted to charge Purdue Pharma executives with felonies that could have sent them to prison. Ending with our usual weekly hubbubs, and I wonder, Joe, if you can tell us about a brief story event that caught your attention this week.
Yes, some numbers that are sort of buried in a Suffolk University poll that came out yesterday. 60%, only 60% of Republicans in Massachusetts approve approve of Charlie Baker's performance. That's very low. And it's almost, Democrats is almost 60% approval as well. So Baker is, it's good news and bad news for Baker. The good news is he's very popular among Democrats, and it indicates he's likely to be reelected because most people do not associate Charlie Baker with Donald Trump. The Democrats are going to try to tie Trump to Baker, but I don't think they're going to be successful based on the results of this poll.
John, you're going to divert from politics?
Yes, I am, actually. My hubbub is about Kyrie Irving, who is not only a Boston Celtics star, but also a filmmaker. He has a film coming out at the end of the month called Uncle Drew. It's based on a character he developed for a series of Pepsi commercials. Pepsi-Cola paid for the screenplay, may have paid for other things as well. At any rate, he plays a 70-something geezer who goes around schooling young people about how to play basketball. Interesting thing was last week, the culture reporter for the Times, Soap and Deb, for the New York Times, had an interview with him. And the headline was, Kyrie Irving doesn't know if the earth is round or flat. He does want to discuss it. And here's the money quote. Irving says, can you openly admit that you know the earth is constitutionally round? Like, you know that for sure?
Constitutionally round, right.
Which leads to the inevitable sequel, Uncle Drew, Flat Earth, Round the Ball, coming to a theater near you.
John Carroll, Boston University journalism professor and WBUR senior news analyst. Joe Battenfeld, Boston Herald political reporter and columnist, host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Nice to talk to you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's much more ahead. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. They're not only playing ball at Fenway Park, they're playing music when the Red Sox are out on the road. This weekend, the Fenway Summer Concert Series begins. All the headline performers this summer are men, and all are white. In fact, for 15 years the Sox organization has been putting on the summer concerts, the overwhelming number of performers have been white males. There is a Roxbury resident who's on a quest to change that, and his journey begins with his relationship with his father. WBUR's arts reporter Maria Garcia has our story.
To really understand Edwin Sumter's passion for the Red Sox summer concerts, you have to go back in time to when his father moved to Boston from South Carolina in the early 50s to escape segregation. In Boston, though, Edwin Sr., who was black, encountered a more subtle but similar set of unspoken rules about where a man like him would be welcomed.
I always felt that my dad was a little bit on edge in the city of Boston and worried about where he would go. But again, he grew up in a different time.
Edwin Sumter's father loved baseball with a passion. He played it too, but he hated the Red Sox. He resented that it was the last major league team to racially integrate, and that Fenway seemed unwelcoming to black folks.
You know, the Red Sox did some things that certainly just made him say, okay, see, I told you. They don't have enough black players. No black fans go to the games and so forth and so on. I would find myself a lot of times sort of, I won't say sticking up for the Red Sox, but I'd say at least telling him to, you know, hang in there, things will change.
Sumter inherited his love of baseball from his father. He loved his hometown and thus his hometown team, much to his dad's disappointment.
Even as I turned into a man, I realized, you know, that's just something we weren't going to share. It always seemed that when I watched baseball with him, especially the Red Sox, it was more than just baseball. It was almost as if we were, you know, two political adversaries going at it.
Sumter was a teenager during busing in the 70s. He remembers being called the N-word at the Esplanade once, being forced to leave out of fear. He has some painful memories of Boston, and yet he loves it still.
I don't know what other word I could use than other to say I love where I'm from. I don't feel that I should feel guilty. I just say that I love my hometown, and I think my hometown could do better, and I think it has.
Today, the Red Sox field a much more diverse team of players and coaches. But in the 15 years since the Boston Red Sox started its summer concert series, it's only had one main performer of color, Jay-Z, who co-headlined with Justin Timberlake in 2013. and only a handful of opening acts with people of color.
We made offers to Beyonce and Drake and Jay-Z to come back and Stevie Wonder, Prince before he passed away.
This is Boston Red Sox president and CEO Sam Kennedy, who has spoken to Sumter about his concern.
We want to make Fenway as diverse as possible with the acts that we go after, but we recognize we can do a better job, and we want everyone to feel welcome and included at Fenway Park.
Kennedy says it's just a matter of logistics. The summer timing limits the performers available, and a lot of big acts prefer other venues, like the more conventional TD Garden or the larger Gillette Stadium, to Fenway's mid-sized 37,000-seat capacity, he says. Here's Don Law, the president of Live Nation New England, which books the performers for Fenway.
Our business is really about doing what the broader population wants so that you can actually pay the cost, the multi-million dollars, to set up a major stadium event. It's not anything to do with personal taste or genre. It's a function of what can sell.
Last year, though, hip-hop and R&B surpassed rock and roll as the most consumed music genre in the U.S., according to Nielsen, the media tracking firm. And there are hip-hop tours this summer performing at big 30,000-seat venues, like Wiz Khalifa with Ray Shrummerd and Kendrick Lamar, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for Music, touring with SZA, among others. The acts performing at Fenway this summer are playing huge venues in other cities, like Luke Bryan at the 82,000-seat MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. But other Fenway performers, like Jimmy Buffett, are also playing smaller 15,000-seat concert halls, similar to many R&B tours. Here's Edwin Sumter again.
I understand the math, and I understand that the color here, that the bottom line is green. I understand all of that. But the fact of the matter is, I was never going to believe that if they really wanted to do something, they couldn't do it.
Sumter's quest to get more performers of color at Fenway may sound trivial to some people, that it's part of this ubiquitous call to diversify everything. But his story touches nerves about race and the legacy of public spaces around Boston. It shows us how collective memory is passed down through generations, about our perceptions of places that are safe, welcoming, and places that seem not to be. So after 50 years of defending the Red Sox to his father, who passed away last year, it was the summer concert series that made Sumter wonder if his father had been right the whole time.
This is exactly the kind of thing my dad would say. See, I told you, the ball club might be multiracial, but they don't want black people to come out to Fenway Park, and here's proof of that. And all I'm trying to do is, Dad, I'm trying to prove you wrong.
That's Edwin Sumter of Roxbury. You can find a picture of him and see the Fenway Concert Series schedule at radioboston.org. Our report was from WBUR Artery Report reporter Maria Garcia. New court filings today are providing a peek behind the curtain of the Harvard University admissions process. The documents are part of a lawsuit filed in 2014 by a group called Students for Fair Admissions. It claims that Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants, and it challenges the so-called whole person approach that Harvard uses to weigh applications. For a look at what the new documents are telling us, we turn to WBUR reporter Fred Tice, who has just spent the day combing through 700 pages. Fred, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Lisa. Still a long way to go.
A long way to go, I can imagine. So far, though, tell us what the thrust is of the group's lawsuit.
So the thrust of it is that Harvard is using tougher standards on Asian Americans to keep the number of those students down on campus.
Okay. And what are we learning from the documents today?
So this is also an opportunity to see what a college goes through when it's looking at students, right? It's a very secretive process, and the curtain's been pulled back a little bit. So among the things that we've learned is that Harvard ranks its applicants on a scale of 1 to 6, 1 being the best, and it does this in a bunch of categories. So there's academic, there's extracurricular activities, there's athletics, there's something called personal, and then there's overall. And the personal one is very subjective. It includes things like personality, and others like to be around him or her, has character traits such as likability, helpfulness, courage, kindness, is an attractive person to be with, is widely respected, is a good person, and has good human qualities. And Harvard tells the people who read the student applications that when they're figuring out the overall score, they need to step back and to take all the factors into account. So it's a more or less subjective kind of thing, and it is that overall score that counts. We also learned something else. You know, Harvard likes to say that it favors low-income applicants, as do many other universities, that it tries to bring them in, first-generation college students. But we learned that it doesn't favor them as much as it favors athletes and students who have relatives who graduated from Harvard.
So athletes and legacy students.
Yes.
The documents, I know, contain some admissions data as well, some of which was provided by Harvard itself. What's in that?
So the group suing Harvard here hired a professor, very respected Duke University professor, to do its data analysis. And he looked at 6 years of admissions data, and he found that an Asian American applicant with a 25% chance of admission would have a 35% chance of admission if that person were white, 75% if he or she were Latino or Latina, and a 95% chance if he or she were African American. Harvard's own documents show that admissions officials assign Asian Americans the lowest score of any racial group on the personal rating. That's that more, nebulous rating. And the group suing Harvard says, if Harvard admitted students based only on their academic index, Asian Americans would comprise over half of the admitted class. And we're also seeing some testimony from a former Harvard employee who conducted data analysis on admissions at Harvard, a former Harvard employee. And he testified that the reports show that Asian Americans are disadvantaged in the admissions process at Harvard. And then cross-examination, he was asked by the plaintiff's attorneys, do you have any explanation other than intentional discrimination for your conclusions regarding the negative association between Asians and the Harvard admissions process? He answered, no, I don't.
So we've heard a lot from the plaintiff in this case. What is Harvard's response?
Harvard issued a long statement today. I'll sum it up for you a little bit. Basically, they're saying that if you look at the data, it's clear that Harvard does not discriminate. And they point out that the admission of Asian Americans over the last 10 years has increased by 29%. That's the admissions. That doesn't mean that they actually ended up coming to Harvard. And Harvard says that Students for Fair Admissions analysis of the data is incomplete and misleading, and for example, because it omits things like personal essays and teacher recommendations.
It omits those things.
It omits those things. The group says, hey, not fair. You're not letting us look at that data, right? Because it would identify all these students, these tens of thousands of students. So they're saying that Harvard, not fair. You'd say that our analysis is omitting that because you won't even show us that.
So this is one more step in the case. Where does it go from here?
So a lot of lines today, and actually big chunks of pages I'm seeing now, are blacked out because Harvard has asked them for them to be blacked out.
Do we know what that is? Is it names? Or?
Harvard is saying, well, they just want to make sure that personal information of students is not brought out, right? Well, it's clear from I'm reading these documents now. It's clear that, all the stuff I'm looking at has nothing to do with personal identification of students. And in 10 days, the judge is expected to decide which documents can stay blacked out and which must be made public. So we could learn a lot more about Harvard's admissions process.
Could the outcome of the case have any effect on other colleges and universities?
Absolutely. This case could very well go to the Supreme Court. Right now, colleges can use race in admissions decisions in a limited way. This lawsuit could test that.
Okay. WBUR's reporter Fred Tice, thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
The lawsuit against Harvard is the latest challenge to the college admissions process. In 2016, the Supreme Court ruled against the same group, Students for Fair Admission, in a similar lawsuit. That one was against the University of Texas at Austin. In that case, the court found that UT's admissions process was indeed fair, and it ruled that the school could continue to use race as one of the factors in judging applicants. An education professor at Harvard has championed the idea of diversity in higher ed. Natasha Wariku has written a book about it, in fact, called The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy in Elite Universities. She joins us now. Welcome, Professor, to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to the claims made in the documents filed today?
So I think one thing that we need to keep in mind is that there's no one best way to think about admissions and when we're thinking about selection. That, you know, if we look at test scores and GPAs, we get one outcome of admissions. If we look at, say, leadership qualities and think about how we might measure that, we might get a different outcome if we think about character. And so if we think about extracurricular excellence and this idea of, you know, let's select students who are, you know, what admissions officers called pointy, you know, have some talent, whether that be, you know, dance talent or musical talent or, you know, research talent, then we might get a whole other set of students. So I think the important thing to keep in mind is that these outcomes are based very much on how we think about what a fair system of selection is, and that selection changes over time, even, you know, within selective universities in the United States over time, even Harvard in particular over time. Harvard's admissions has changed over the decades of the 20th century. And so, you know, I think it's important for us to see that this reflects what is the sort of current priorities of the university, of a broader society.
So what might be a 1 versus a 6, you know, on that scale that Fred mentioned, one might be a 1 this year, might not have been a 1 in 1965.
It might not have even been a category. You know, the categories may have been different in 1965.
So doesn't that just say it's always going to be a subjective call, though?
I think that's right. I mean, I think, you know, we need to think about what is the purpose of the university? What is our university trying to do? And how does the way that we select students further that mission, right? So if we think of, you know, Harvard talks a lot about educating the leaders of tomorrow, then we need to think about, well, how do we measure the qualities of leadership? What is important in our leadership? You know, the Sandra Day O'Connor in the last decision talked about, you know, in the 2006 decision about the importance of a leadership that reflects the society. So how do we ensure that, you know, people see themselves in their leadership? I think that's something to think about as well.
Professor, hang on one second. Fred Tice is still in the studio here, and I think he has a question for you.
No, well, you know, one of the things I was talking about this with a very respected economist, Susan Donarski at University of Michigan. She's looked at the interpretations by both sides of this data, and I don't know if – have you done that yourself, and can you speak to how each side is cutting up the data to favor itself at all?
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read the analyses of the two. I know there's an economist on both sides, and they have different interpretations of the data. So I did read that the ratings for Asian Americans on these kind of more, say, holistic characteristics were lower than other students, which is troubling. But I can't say more than that because I don't know the data.
What is the model that you would use to create a more fair and equitable admissions process?
So from my perspective, I like to think about this as, you know, I think this idea that we can actually rank students and say, you know, out of tens of thousands of the applicants that come to a place like Harvard, selecting that 1 in 20 student that is the best of the best, I think the idea that we can actually do that, for me, is problematic. So I think, you know, that we could have some sort of bar to say that, you know, you have to have a certain level of academic skills, a certain, you know, demonstrate whatever it is, a certain quality, say, in those six areas, a competency in these six areas. And then let's have a lottery and say, you know, the reality is, you know, Drew Faust has even talked about this. We could fill the class of Harvard twice over with, you know, amazing students. Valedictorians routinely get rejected because we just, again, you could fill the class with people who have all of these amazing qualities. And there are so many amazing young people in this country. And I think if we had some form of a lottery and you could have provision for whatever is important to the university, athletics, you know, legacies. I would disagree with legacies, but, you know, many, you know, if that's whatever, what have you, representation. And it would really sort of signal that these people who get selected are lucky, right? And they've worked hard, but they're also lucky.
So
right?
You're saying create a baseline and then everything above that would be decided by a lottery?
That's right.
How would that, though, bring about a more diverse student body?
Well, I think for me it would signal that you can never devise a system that is completely fair and that a pure meritocracy. To me, that the idea of a meritocracy in an unequal society is problematic because we have unequal resources in our society. There's the ongoing effects of historical discrimination and exclusion that's very hard to tease these things out. In terms of diversity, I would say, I think we need to separate also this issue of Asian Americans from affirmative action. And I think, Blum has and his associates have never cared about racial discrimination until this case. And this is really a backhanded way of attacking affirmative action, right? And that's really his goal, as the previous case made clear. And so, but the Supreme Court has ruled that there is a compelling state interest in a diverse student body and a diverse learning environment. And so we want to be able to say that, yes, we want a quorum of underrepresented minorities on campus. And that is a very different issue from, whether this issue of Asian Americans. And I think we need to make that clear as well.
All right. Natasha Waraku, we're going to leave it right there. Natasha Waraku is an education professor at Harvard University, author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Very nice to have you on Radio Boston. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the story of a man who ran the Appalachian Trail averaging 50 miles a day. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Next month marks the three-year anniversary of ultramarathoner Scott Jurek's record-breaking run of the Appalachian Trail. He ran from Springer Mountain in Georgia to Mount Katahdin in Maine. It took him 46 days, 8 hours, 7 minutes. Jurek has won almost all the elite events in ultra running. He won the Western States 100-mile endurance run a record 7 times. But running the Appalachian Trail was a different kind of challenge. He and his wife, Jenny, have written about it in their book called North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. We spoke this spring about their personal trial on and off the trail.
Well, I think, after racing for 20 years, I needed a new challenge, something to really kind of push me to those boundaries that other challenges had done in the past.
And Jenny, you didn't really like the idea of his doing the trail in the beginning, did you?
Well, it just seemed really random to me, and it seemed like something really involved that would take a lot of planning. And from the previous races I'd seen, he wasn't really into it. Like, his heart wasn't into it. So I didn't want to put all this time and effort into doing something that he wasn't going to do with that passion. But I did realize, that it was a way to reignite that fire for him.
But Jenny, this way involves you because you ended up kitting out a van and driving to Georgia to begin the trail. And Scott, meanwhile, from up atop the trail, tell us what it was like for you.
I just had to follow those white blazes that are iconic on the Appalachian Trail and also go up and down these mountains, climbing each day. I mean, the trail climbs 500,000 feet up, 500,000 feet down, over 2,200 miles. So a lot of days involve 10,000 to 15,000 feet of climbing and 10 to 15,000 feet of descent. And so it definitely was challenging in its own right. Amidst that, we decided to open up the journey and let people in on it by occasionally posting on social media, but we also had a tracker and people could literally follow along wherever they were. And as we got along the trail, we had basically people showing up at trailhead, sometimes, 10, sometimes 20, 30, and some were definitely a little bit, probably more overbearing on Jenny because she had to answer all their questions as they were hanging out. But they also got to join me for miles. So it really was this social, and I think that's what the Appalachian Trail, it is a social trail. It was designed to connect people as well as nature.
So people would run with you as well.
Exactly.
Did that hold you back? I mean, you were doing this to time.
It probably wasn't the best. My buddy Speed Goat, who's in the book, joined us 2 weeks in because he's like, man, you guys need help. And he was like, this is slowing you down. You got to get rid of that tracker. And for some reason, for me, I just felt like I needed that connection. And I loved hearing the stories from people, but it did get a little old to answer all their questions. And I know some people were out there like, he's answering the same questions every time somebody pulls into the next trailhead and they're joining them for the next, 5 or 10 miles.
Yeah, I actually heard about the fact that you were doing the Appalachian Trail from a teenager who lives nearby and who was on the trail alone and ran into you. And she was surprised that you answered her questions as well. And she was really kind of enchanted. But on a day-to-day, actually minute-by-minute level, what was it like for you, Scott? These are the questions you probably are sick of answering, but I think everybody has them. I mean, how would you sleep? How would you eat? Did you ever shower over 46 days?
So the short answer is the basic needs became more and more primitive as I went along. And Jenny can vouch for this as I started to smell more and more. Yeah. She was the one who's picking ticks off of me with a headlamp at the end of the day. But for me, it was meeting my basic needs of fueling, and that was done on the run. Jenny would do some cooking. Showers got thrown out of the window. Maybe I'd bathe in a creek, or maybe it became basically a wet towel at the end of the night. And sometimes I just roll into bed. Sometimes I slept on the trail, on rocks, or when I would take naps for a half hour here and there. Things became more and more dire and more, primitive as we went along.
And when that happened, did you ever stop and just say, well, why am I doing this again?
Definitely. I mean, every day there were times when I'm like, this is just stupid. Can I be doing this via another, means or another activity or passion? Maybe I need to find a different hobby. I'm not going to lie. There were the times where I told Jenny, it seemed like it was pulling us apart rather than bringing us together.
Because you had different ideas of what you wanted to do. I mean, at that point, you were how old?
I was 41 at the time.
And that was a big factor in your decision.
Definitely. Definitely towards the end of my career, I needed something. And I also wanted to save some of these bigger challenges because I knew it would take experience, not only in sport and what I love to do, but also in life. Jenny and I had struggled with trying to raise a family, having children. And, I watched Jenny almost die in my arms on our kitchen floor a year and a half prior in it. And so it was one of these things where like, life is short. And we need to do this now.
Jenny, what Scott was just referring to there was that you had, and you write about this in the book, an ectopic pregnancy. The baby was developing in your fallopian tube. At the time that Scott was running the Appalachian Trail, you had suffered from the effects of a miscarriage that you'd had earlier, but you kept that fact from him then?
That was a little worrisome, but I wasn't about to mention it to Scott because I knew he would freak out and I knew that he would consider stopping, and we were just too close, and I just kind of risked it and hoped that everything would be okay, and it was.
I give you guys a lot of credit for the openness with which you tell your individual stories. I mean, you're such a good pair, but you talk about the friction, and like you said, you talk about the fact that it's hard to stay together with things in your life and with the things that you want to do with your life. What's worked?
I don't know. I think just that we're good communicators has been really helpful.
And understanding each other. I think that's a key part, too, is yes, there were times that we had a couple of blowouts out on the trail, but we still came together and communicated after. And I think realized like why we were doing this instead of packing it up and going home like we thought about doing as we were getting very close to the end.
You both also had to deal with a lot of flack that was coming in from the outside. People saying, look, you're running this beautiful trail that misses the point. How did you respond to that?
Well, I think the initial response is Jenny and I get emotional a little bit, but then I've gotten used to I'm going to have haters. 90 some percent of the people out there. In fact, all the thru-hikers that I would spend time with, they loved the fact of what I was doing and they understood like we got the thru-hiking experience and we did really enjoy it. I wasn't moving much faster than most thru-hikers. I just spent more time on the trail each day. There were days that I didn't stop moving.
In the end, you beat the old record, Scott, by 3 hours, 13 minutes. You didn't hold the record for long, though. Is that okay?
Oh, it's definitely okay. And I don't think it's a major spoiler because a lot of people could look this up. But I went back and helped my buddy Speed Goat, and I watched him break my record those last 10 days. And I think that's what the sport is all about. I think that's what life is about. You should help even somebody who's your competitor, maybe friend, raise the bar, do something that they didn't think they could do. And that's what I love about it. And since then, it's been broken again. So it's almost like the record's only stood for a year now each time. So it wasn't so much about the record. The record was the tool to push me that next level that I needed to push myself, to really see if I could get every ounce of effort out of my body, mind, and soul. It was really this all-encompassing. It was like living, I guess, multiple lifetimes. If I were to sum it up, it was like, you know, life experiences that you could only have by pushing yourself that far.
Scott and Jenny Jurek, their book is called North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. So nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
And that's it for our show for today and for this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our program's produced by Jamie Bologna with Chris Sitterick and Paris Alston with help from Cassandra Sunt and Priyanka Deo. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston.